24 minutes after the hour. It's a winsome Wednesday morning, and typically Doug Greenwald joins us. Let's put out a call. Calling Doug Greenwald. Calling Doug Greenwald. Doug, are you?
Typically, I'm here.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, you are. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times and the Executive Director thereunto pertaining. And Doug teaches us context. He tells us what's been in the Bible all along, but few of us have been able to see. And when you learn that, it makes a huge difference in your understanding. Doug, there's a lot of weather sweeping across the country. I'm wondering how it's affecting you out east there. You're out in Columbia, Maryland, just on the a stone's throw from Washington.
I just got a text from a friend who's informing me that on Saturday we could be expecting 5 to 8 inches of snow in Washington, D.C. Be great for the cherry festival.
Mm-hmm. We'll match the cherry blossoms out there.
And then, I don't know whether these two pieces of dots can be connected or not, but I just learned that Al Gore is going to be speaking at the graduation ceremony of the University of Maryland.
Well, he should be greeted with snowballs, I think.
Yeah. You know, he may be at the podium with a parka and galoshes.
I think it would be appropriate, yeah. Okay. Well, good luck out there, Al, if you're listening today. I mean, yeah.
Might want to change your copy a little bit.
Well, a few last-minute edits. We'll be good. We'll be good. Well, Doug, we've talked over the past couple of weeks about some of the events in the last 40 days of Jesus. We talked about Lazarus. We talked about Palm Sunday entrance into Jerusalem. So much goes on during that week, and I think routinely we Western Christians think of, well, okay, he's arrived and then he's crucified. But there was stuff happening in between of great significance. And how about the Last Supper? When did it happen and where?
Well, before I jump into that one, I was just thinking to myself the other day, you know, half of the Gospel of John has to deal with the last 40 days in the life of Jesus. It's a big subject.
Yeah, it is. Would be.
And what I'm going to do in the next several weeks is go through the rest of the Gospels and do a proportionality kind of thing. What percent of it is devoted towards either Passion Week or the last 40 days of Jesus? And I'll bet the total weighted average of all four Gospels is going to come out to be like 1/3 of all the Gospels is focused on the last 40 days of the life of Jesus. So that's to suggest there's a wealth of material there. There's a wealth of context, and as you might expect, there's a wealth of things yet to be discovered. And this is sort of leaning us towards the topical theme for the 2019 Institute of Biblical Context Summer Conference, which is most likely going to be on the last 40 days of Jesus, the greatest story never told. Actually, to be technically correct, probably should say the greatest story never totally told, the greatest story never completely told. But there is a ton of information, insight, challenge, and comfort yet to be discovered in the last 40 days of the life of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels.
Now, when you say the last 40 days, you're talking about up to the resurrection, not up to like Pentecost, which was, what,
correct.
50 days. So. Okay.
Correct. And that generally starts with the raising of Lazarus in John 11. So when we get to the upper room discourse in the Last Supper, we probably should ask that question we always like to ask. Question number one, where are we? And if you go to Luke's 22nd chapter, the 10th verse, Jesus is setting up the Last Supper, and he tells some of his disciples, as you enter the city is Jerusalem, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters, and say to the owner of the house, the teacher, or Rabboni, ask, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there. Now, as we have observed time and time again in our Wednesday ruminations on biblical context, Every word is there for a reason. And I think a lot of people just go by this and read about a man carrying a jar of water, and it doesn't strike them how peculiar that is. Because in this culture, men don't carry water jars, women do.
Now, so you're suggesting that the original hearers might have raised an eyebrow when they heard that. That would have struck a note with them.
Well, more than raised an eyebrow, they said, oh, they're going to the Essene quarter of Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
There are no women in the Essene quarter. All the Essenes are celibate. And you ask yourself, well, how do they keep the movement going? And the answer most likely is through adoption. And just to push that thought back a little bit further, John the Baptist, or who we have long called John the Immerser, was born very late in life of Zachariah and Elizabeth. And most people feel that by the time he was a teenager, a young teenager, his parents were dead. And tradition says that the Essene community out there in Qumran, in the wilderness of Judea, adopted him. And he was raised essentially as an Essene orphan. And that explains his Spartan nature, his love of the Judean wilderness, that kind of thing. Remember now that John the Baptist is a cousin of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus would have been familiar with the Essene community and the Essene world. And so pause that thought. Now I have to go back in time about 30 years before the birth of Jesus. And one of the Essene elders made a very favorable prophecy for a newly minted king named Herod the Great, who claimed that he would have a long and prosperous reign. And in appreciation for that very favorable prophecy, Herod the Great gave this elder of the Essenes movement up to a quarter of the real estate in Jerusalem to establish the Essene community there, because at about this same time, there was a tremendous earthquake that had come through that part of the world and had destroyed the Essene community out in the Judean wilderness, and they needed a new place to be. So there is an Essene community in Jerusalem. It's substantial in the first century. And if you ever get a chance to go to the Israel Museum, and just as you walk in the main entrance, you're suddenly in a big outdoor area, maybe half the size of a football field. You will see a model of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. And you can see the Essene quarter. And they actually have a monastery built in that Essene quarter. And so when you connect all these dots together, that's most likely where the Last Supper took place, in the guest room of an Essene monastery in the Essene quarter in Jerusalem. There'd be another good reason for doing that. This allows Jesus to get away from the crowds a little bit and to get away from the prying aristocracy who's trying to track his every movement, to give him a little space and a little quiet for his upper room discourse, that which he's going to have as a part of their Last Supper experience.
Now, the Essenes kind of lived like we might picture survivalists, right? The bare bones existence, kind of no frills, almost like an Amish approach to life. What was their philosophy?
They very much rejected the ostentatiousness of the temple aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
They objected to the corruption of Jewish leadership. They objected to the theology, or the lack thereof, of the Sadducees. And so they just pulled out maybe 30 years before and said, we're going to go in the wilderness and await the arrival of the King of Righteousness, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote in a very different language than Jews wrote. They talked about lightness and darkness. And what's interesting here is, maybe in the early 1900s, there started to be a movement that the Gospel of John could never have been written by a Jew, because the language that's used in it of light and dark is not prototypical Jewish language at all. And then in 1948, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered and they started to do the analysis of the writings of the Essene community, there they found this language of lightness and darkness, and the same kind of language that is used in the Gospel of John in portions. And that put to bed, that put in the grave, if you will, the theory that the Gospel of John could not have been written by a Jew because the Essenes are completely Jewish.
Does that suggest that John also was close to the Essenes, perhaps through Jesus, or perhaps even by his own association with them?
Or he certainly was very familiar with them, mm-hmm. and shaped by them. Mm-hmm. How that would have happened, maybe John, the apostle, in the early days, dialogued with John the Baptist. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. But he was also close to the hierarchy in Jerusalem, because he was there at the trial. So he had a special, a privileged position somehow with perhaps both camps.
That's true. And remember this also. Where did some of the early disciples come from that Jesus called? They were disciples of John the Baptist.
Uh-huh.
So all the things that John would have taught them, they just carried into their relationship with Jesus, all the history and background that John would have taught them, presumably some of which was about the Essenes, they would have been aware of. So when Jesus says, look for a man, they knew exactly what that meant. And that's how we have pretty high probability that the Last Supper took place in an Essene monastery in the Essene quarter of Jerusalem in their guest room.
Do you suspect that the Essenes would have recognized Jesus as their great teacher?
I suspect some of them would. In fact, at this moment in time, I suspect many of them would, for the very reason that even in standard observant Judaism, there were many a rabbi who said that bringing back someone from the dead is so difficult, it will only happen when Messiah comes. And that's what the whole raising of Lazarus is about. Lazarus is the calling card of Jesus, that he is indeed the Messiah. He's walking evidence. He's exhibit A, that Jesus truly is the Messiah. And that raising of Lazarus would not have been lost on the Essene community as well.
So, again, I'm thinking of the temperature of social interactions must have increased tremendously during that last 40 days as a result of the raising of Lazarus. Jesus had to be the talk of the town.
Not only the talk of the town, but his wanted poster was on every palm tree in Judea, as was Lazarus's, by the way, because he's exhibit A, that someone really did come back to life in Lazarus' case. On the fourth day, and we talked about the significance of that a couple of weeks ago, that's undeniable proof that Jesus is Messiah. And so, yeah, there's a lot of curious people there. And as we talked about last week with Palm Sunday, a lot of people now with incredibly high expectations. Revolt is in the air. Revolution is in the air. The Romans are about to be overthrown. It's Passover time. We're leaving the Roman Empire just like we left Egypt. You know, all that sort of thing.
Interesting. So they're at the Essene Quarter, and the context seems to establish that pretty well. What does that say about when the Last Supper might have happened?
You know, there's a missing day, or a quiet day, a day where apparently nothing happens in the narratives when you put them all together, and that's been the subject of a lot of debate. Typically, that's where our Maundy Thursday concept comes from, you know, Thursday evening before the Friday. Some people will argue, no, it was on a Wednesday. Some people argue that, hey, there are two calendars at work here. The Essene calendar that they subscribe to was very different than the Jewish calendar because you have both the solar calendar and the lunar calendar at work here, and they're off by one day during Passion Week. So it kind of depends on which calendar you want to subscribe to, which day of the week you say this is going to take place. So if we fuse those two thoughts together, it might have been a Wednesday night, it might have been a Thursday night.
There's another factor here that I've read about, and I wonder if you can confirm or dispel this notion that the Sanhedrin, the court of law, had a rule that before a death sentence could be executed, 24 hours had to pass so they could reconsider, which fills an extra day. Does that make sense?
There is a lot of debate that took place. Let's just call this whole backdrop the trial. Mm-hmm. And the protocol of a trial, and whether or not the Sanhedrin could pass the death sentence. Yes, no, there's some debate about that. That's actually a very large subject. And if indeed we do that theme of the last 40 days of Jesus for our 2019 conference, I think we'll take 30 to 45 minutes and just deal with the context of the trial. And then that would be one piece of it that we'd have to deal with. But I think the more interesting thing, back to the upper room here, is in the second century after the death of Jesus in Alexandria, in the Jewish quarter in Egypt, there was found the remains of a manuscript of a play. And the play had to do with the seating arrangement around the triclinium table. That's the kind of table that would have been used in this upper room situation here. And triclinium is Latin. Tri is three and clinium is two, recline. And so a triclinium table, it's a Roman table, has three sides to it. And the protocol is, if you can think of this three-sided table as like the letter U in our alphabet, rotated on its side, let's say 90 degrees to the left here, so that the open side of the U is now on our left-hand side, that top part of the U is where the most important people sat in the room. And across from them, which is now the bottom part of the U lying on its side, is where the least important people sat. And the middle side is where the intermediate important people sat. And so when you went to somebody's house for a meal, and it was going to be at the triclinium table, you had to know your place. You had to know where you're set. And this may help explain a little bit why the disciples, just a very short time here before this upper room situation, were arguing over who's the greatest in the kingdom. It could be as simple as the fact that they were trying to figure out where to sit at table for Passover. Okay. Now, on the most important people side, the very first seat is where the host sits. The seat next to the host is where the guest of honor sits. And next to the guest of honor is a person who's allowed to be his guest of honor. And then we go all the way around the table until the bottom side here at the very left-hand end is the least important seat on the least important side, and that's known as the servant seat. And when we put the four Gospels back together, what's fascinating here is John is the guest of honor. He's in seat number one. Jesus is in seat number two. And guess who Jesus chose to be his guest of honor in seat number three?
Judas.
Judas Iscariot, because the text tells us the one I dip with, okay? Mm. This has to be the one next to him. There's also a singular reference to Peter beckoning to John. And we're pretty well convinced that that puts Peter in the least important seat on the least important side, the servant seat, directly across from John. And that may well explain why Peter is the one who objects when Jesus gets up at a point during that meal, removes his tunic, puts on a towel, and begins to wash everyone's feet. When he gets to Simon, Simon objects. And we might ask, well, is there a reason why he might have objected? And a good answer is suggested that the one who sat in the servant seat is required to wash the feet of everyone in the room, absent any women in the room. And Peter, our rabbi in training, didn't do one of his obligatory obligations yet again. Mm. And the whole irony of this is it looks like Jesus would have intentionally placed Peter in the servant seat as his last act of training to be the successor rabbi of the band, which we see him being in early Acts. So some really interesting seating dynamics going on at the Last Supper.
That's fascinating. You got to be a detective. How would we know this if it weren't for you, Doug?
Well, you just have to find all the contextual pieces, and other people have found them in the past, and so I just run across them, and then you have to be a knitter. You have to knit all these facts together into a cohesive narrative.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Now, you mentioned something in passing, or it was part of what you said, but you said if there were no women in the room, is there any indication that there were women in the room?
No. That's part of what the Essene Quarter would suggest. But normally, Passover is a family event. And so those disciples that were married presumably could have had their families there, or at least their wives. And so, you know, did Jesus make this sort of a special Passover? Was this truly a Passover? Was this a partial Passover? The very fact that there appear to be no women in the room, again, suggests some other dynamics contextually. And that just makes a basic point.
So this was not a traditional Seder supper then?
Some would say it isn't. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some would say one of the four elements of the Seder is missing. There's just an awful lot of contextual discussion that goes on here. Just want to leave us with this observation. The more context you discover, the bigger the story becomes, the wider the circumference becomes, and the wider the circumference becomes, the more new issues show up that you never thought of before. And David, you just illustrated that.
And the more human it becomes, the more real people it becomes.
Exactly.
That's astounding. Just good. I
know that there was a natural pause at what you just said, but do we know if any of the disciples were married?
Well, Peter had a mother-in-law, so.
We strongly suspect they were. In the normal flow of things, you get married between the ages of 18 and 21. Okay.
Right.
It's hard to believe that all of these 11 or 12 disciples would have somehow not fit that paradigm.
Okay. I just finished listening to Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code again, just as a little escapist literature, and so my head is buzzing with the big M in Da Vinci's Leonardo da Vinci's painting, and the existence of Mary Magdalene and all the rest of that. So,
well, when you mention Dan Brown, let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. The website, it's a beautiful website, by the way, preservingbibletimes.org. And if you go there, you can sign up for Doug's monthly newsletter. I should say maybe newsletters, plural, because sometimes there's two or three of them called Reflections. They come in your email. There's no charge for them, and you will look forward to getting them every month because they will just brighten your day. And Doug, you brightened ours. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, guys.
There's a lot more questions, a lot more about the Last Supper and the events right after that. So hopefully we can take that up next week, huh?
Or maybe go in some new directions.
Yeah, well, that's possible too. We'll look forward to it. Thank you, Doug.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doug.
Shalom.
Shalom.